Hi, folks. This is Brad Watson, pastor at Nexus Church. We are glad you have found our sermon podcast and that you're interested in our teachings. If you've ever considered financially supporting our work at Nexus Church, you can do that at nexuschurch.ca/give. Thanks for listening and thanks for your support.
Good morning, everyone. Hope you woke with a pep in your step like I did today. Oh, resurrection. At last, it's Easter again, and this morning, we celebrate the resurrection of Jesus. What exactly, though, is the victory of this day? What is the hope? What does it anticipate? Why does the Christian calendar point to this day, this event, as the pivotal moment of history? I want to try to shed some light on that in seven movements this morning. Seven movements. Movement one, the early 1920s, after witnessing the absolute horror of World War I, William Butler Yeats penned a poem entitled The Second Coming. His haunting words were demonstrated in that video this morning. Yeats looked around the world and saw its complete destruction in his mind, a culture of death. And Yeats looked at the world and realized that everything had fallen apart. And the reason behind it is captured in one powerful line of his poem, "Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity." I love that line, "The center cannot hold." What Yeats seems to express here is that in the end, nothing guarantees love or life or goodness. Good things might occur to us, might occur within history, but ultimately they're accidents, random happenings, the product of chance, you could say. The very opposite, you could say, of what believing in resurrection means. The order that we've come to love and appreciate about our world may not, in fact, hold. And the billionaires seem to think it won't hold. I was intrigued by this headline just this week. "From luxury bunkers to tactical vehicles, the ultra-rich are preparing for the big one." And I was able to get in, right? Look at the Mark Zuckerberg. Oh, Mark. Building his huge home, which includes a 5,000-square-foot bunker. I tell you, the billionaires building their bunkers. They don't think the center's going to hold. Well, the rest of us schmucks will be left to care for ourselves, the rich retreating to their bunkers. You know, trust in Jesus' resurrection for me is a very practical thing. It's an everyday trust. It's a feeling, a sense that no matter how tired, worn down, or full of doubt, the center will hold. And Eliza and her mother did this art for us. You'll remember on Good Friday, it was just lines of chaos. But on Resurrection Sunday, there's a center line now. And I love it. The center will hold. That's the faith we have in the resurrection, that despite the chaos, there's a center that will hold. There's a rock to stand on. There's a deep anchor that's holding everything together. I had a powerful reminder of this. First time I visited Zion National Park, friend Riley and I were touring around, and we did this hike that brought us to Weeping Rock, it's called. You travel up this path, and you stand underneath this giant rock, millions of years old, and it just drips a little bit of water, Weeping Rock, they call it. But as we're standing there, we're looking out over this canyon valley. And right as we're there, we hear bang, thunder, lightning. And everyone who was there with us took off. They seemed to know more than we did. They were gone. Took off. We're like, that's curious. But before long, we found ourselves in the middle of an incredible storm. Lightning, thunder all around us. It's pouring. I didn't realize it at the time, but Zion National Park is very susceptible to flash floods. And so any sort of rain there is trouble. And as the rain came down and was beating, it was just this metaphor of everything feeling at danger, everything feeling like it could fall apart. And we're standing there under this rock holding. And right at that moment, my friend Riley launches into song. Rock of ages, cleft for me. Let me hide myself in thee, naked come to thee for dress, helpless look to thee for grace, rock of ages cleft for me, let me hide myself in thee. In that moment, this feeling, despite the storms in life, there's a center that will hold. I consider faith to be a very practical thing. It asks us to trust that the universe is safe, that there's a safe hold in the storm. To trust in the resurrection is to look at all of life. All of our failings, all of our doubts, our insecurities, even death itself, and believe the center is going to hold. And for our part, that means that our inadequacies, our failings, our self-doubt, even our own deaths are not the final answer. Movement two. What most moves your heart, Brad? Someone asked me this question recently. What most moves your heart? Where do you most naturally feel a sense of compassion? And I stumbled at the time on the answer, but in hindsight, it seems rather easy to me. My heart is most moved when I witness helplessness. Just outside my office in my home, there's this window. My desk overlooks it, and I'm often very distracted by what I've come to know as the neighborhood villain, Bully Cat, black and white cat, and he just wreaks havoc in the neighborhood. Out my window, there's this shed like this, and he sits on top of the shed and waits till birds fly over, then his surprise attacks them, jumps up, tries to grab them. And one day, I'm sitting in my office, and I look out the window, and Bully Cat is doing the cat thing, it's got something. Oh, Bully Cat, look out, it's some sort of chipmunk. It's just playing with it, and I can't take any more. So I head outside, go up to Bully Cat, and it's just holding this chipmunk, looking at me like, what you gonna do about it, huh? Like, shoo. It's like, shoo. Wouldn't move, it was just holding this chipmunk down, and the chipmunk's looking at me, just, please. So I did that, scat. Finally got Bully Cat away, but the chipmunk didn't move, and I had to play Gandalf. I'm like, fly, you fool. Get going. The cat's going to come back. Finally, it ran off, but there's something in me when the smallest thing, just the chipmunk about to die, moves my heart. Whenever I see someone who's helpless, unable to protect themselves, unable to attend to their own needs, whenever I see embarrassment in the eyes of another person, those moments tend to break our hearts, don't they? Like the time I walked out of my house One morning, I came out, and there was just a little girl standing in the driveway. I said, "Hello?" She said, "Hi, I don't know where my mom is, and I don't know how to get home." Okay, sweetheart, let's help you find your mom, right? Those moments of helplessness, or those moments that I've stood by hospital beds with those who are sick, in pain, dying, helpless to get better. It's the unemployed person down on their luck. They're unable to find work when everybody else seems to be doing great, but they just feel so helpless. It's in those moments that I spend with people over coffee, and they begin to cry how helpless they feel in life. Helplessness, it tugs at our heart. And in many ways, helplessness is what defines the human condition. No matter what sort of layers we want to put over top of it, helplessness is the human condition. John Shea refers to this as the cries of finitude. You know, there's this story very early in the Gospel of John. I consider it a resurrection story. Jesus is at a wedding. And in the middle of the wedding, whether it's because they were a poor couple, in the middle of the wedding, they run out of wine. It's 10 p.m., the DJ's just started, everybody's having a good time, and boom, they run out of wine. And Mary, mother of Jesus, can tell it moves her heart. She can see their helplessness. And in the grand scheme of things, it might not be a huge helplessness, but they're embarrassed. They're ashamed. They've run out of wine. Mary's heart is moved, and so she goes to Jesus, says, "Do something. Do something. They have no wine, Jesus, do something." And at one level, this is a specific request on behalf of a particular couple, but this is John, the great artist that's writing here. The story is deeply symbolic. Mary speaks for this couple, but she's really speaking for all of us. Because the truth in life is this: we all run out of wine. God alone is not finite. God alone does not suffer from the indignity of helplessness. But for the rest of us, we are finite. Our wine eventually runs out. Ultimately, we're ultimately helpless because we're subject to illness and hunger and fatigue and irritation and entropy, diminishment, ultimately death. And no matter how strong and confident and self-sufficient we are, no matter what we do to keep the demons of helplessness at bay, finitude and mortality will find us all. Tiredness, illness, diminishment, death will eventually find us. Our wine is going to run out. So the story is a resurrection story. It's a resurrection promise. A human dilemma is posed in the words of Mary: their wine have run out. But the promise of resurrection is that Jesus will restore and fill the jugs to overflowing. There'll be more than enough wine to go around. Resurrection is about that, the end of finitude. Everything that diminishes us in life, everything that depletes us, everything that takes life away from us and makes us helpless, resurrection is, "Oh, I'll fill the jugs." God has heard the cries of finitude, and God will restore the wine so it never runs out. Movement 3, to believe in the resurrection is to be comforted by the notion, the idea that nothing in life is ultimately a threat. Not terrorism, not guns, not war or disease or climate change or aging or horrible politicians. Nothing is ultimately a threat because the center will hold. So Jesus' resurrection, why we do this once a year, it's a reminder to turn on the lights. Turn on the lights for us to see the bigger picture beyond death. I like Peter Berger says this: "Consider the ordinary gesture by which a mother reassures her anxious child. Child wakes up in the night, perhaps from a bad dream, finds himself surrounded by darkness, alone, beset by nameless threats. At such a moment, the contours of trusted reality are blurred and invisible. In the terror of incipient chaos, the child cries out for his mother. It is hardly an exaggeration to say that at this moment, the mother is being invoked as a high priestess of protective order. It is she, and in many cases, she alone, who has the power to banish the chaos and to restore the benign shape of the world. And of course, any good mother will do just that. She will take the child and cradle them. She will turn on a lamp, perhaps, which will encircle the scene with a warm glow of reassuring light. She will speak or sing to the child, and the content of this communication will invariably be the same. Don't be afraid. Everything is in order. Everything is all right. Jesus' resurrection comes to us as that warm glow of reassuring light. It's God's way of turning on the lamp, you could say, for just a moment in the dark, whispering, "See, don't be afraid. It's all right. Morning's coming, the center will hold." This Christmas, Kristen and I got ourselves a little day at Thermea Spa in Whitby. I was so excited because this is the new big spa in Ontario, right? And boy, the sauna game there is tremendous. This place is phenomenal. But what I was really excited about is that Thermea Spa, they have a float pool. And you know how I like floating, folks. A float pool, but this was no solitary one. It's about the size of the floor here. It's a communal float pool. You go in, you float, it's heated to the temperature of your skin, so you feel like you disappear. Magical. So we get to Thermea Spa, and we go downstairs, and it gets really, really dim downstairs into this chamber, this float pool. And the first thing you got to do is you got to put on headphones, listen to their little instruction thing. So you put on the headphones, and I'm paraphrasing here, but it goes something like this. "This will be the most relaxing experience of your life. However, if you get water in your eyes, you will cry and scream and beg for mercy, so don't get the water in your eyes. But this will be the most relaxing experience you've ever had." I'm like, why? There's so much salt in this water to make you float. Something like 600 pounds per square foot. I don't know, whatever the math is. It's so buoyant. And so the thing's like, "This, you're going to love this, but really, seriously, do not get water in your eyes." So I'm like, okay, just going to keep my eyes shut the whole time. Fine. So we go and we come into the chamber and there's people just floating around. Everybody's floating and they got the new age music playing. And they got little pillows for your neck so you can float. So Kristen and I, we go, we get our little pillows, we wade into the water. It's only about up to here. We go into the water, trying to be careful. And you're like, if you move, you're like a cork. So we got to get ourselves set up. So, okay, I'll help Kristen get set up. She gets set up floating. She's just floating there. I'm like, okay, it's my turn. So I'm like, don't get water in my eyes. So I close my eyes real tight. Close my eyes. I'm shuffling around. I get floating. And I'm sitting there floating, and I'm like, this is the greatest experience of my life. I'm so happy, I'm so grateful. And I go and I put my hand just to gently rub Kristen's back, just to let her know that I'm grateful to be here. And in that moment, two thoughts arrived basically at the same time, followed by a third. And my first thought was this: I know I don't always notice little details about Kristen, and that's on me. But in that moment, the thought was, this is strange. I don't remember Kristen having a really hairy back. Huh. Interesting. And then the second thought landed right on top of it. I think you're petting a really hairy man. And I don't want to get water in my eyes. So I got my eyes closed. And a second later, I wish this one had come right away. Then the third thought was stop rubbing the back. And so I took my hand away, and I don't want to open my eyes. It's so dark in there. I'm just like, oh, what was that? Why does Kristen have a hairy back? And my world had fallen apart. I don't know where I am. I've got to open my eyes. I got to risk getting water in my eyes. And I open it, and there's the light, finally. And I look beside me, and I was correct. A very hairy man was there. And so I started to panic. Where's Kristen? I turn around, and she's just laughing behind me, laughing. And so I made my way. I said, where did you go? She said, I couldn't help it. I laid back, and I just floated away. And this guy, like ship in the night, he just floated right in. And said, I just watched you start petting his back. And I said, well, what did he do? She said, it was the best. Both of you were trying to keep your eyes closed. So he was just like, complete terror in that moment. I feel bad for the man. He still kept his eyes closed. He was going with it. But in that moment of chaos, my whole world came undone. I didn't know where I was. I just needed a moment of light. To know everything was okay. Need the lights on for just a moment. This is the power of resurrection. Because we're fumbling around in the darkness, and it's easy for our worlds to just feel like they're spiraling out of control. Easter Sunday morning is the lights on, just real quick. Warm glow of reassuring light. I needed a quick peek with the lights on, and then I could go back to the darkness. And this is why we return to Easter Sunday, year after year. Because we all have those moments in our life when we need a quick glimpse of the world with the lights on. Jesus' resurrection is turning on the lights for a moment so we can get our bearing. Sunday, we remind ourselves there is hope. There is goodness. It's good to reflect on hope in a world full of chaos. And Eliza and the Nexus kids, Eliza asked them to reflect on where they found moments of hope. And so I'm gonna actually ask my daughter Zoe to come. She's going to read for us where the Nexus kids found moments of hope. There you go.
First of all, I would like to point out that story was very cringy. Okay. But anyways, I'm here to talk about hope and what we, the Nexus kids, think about it. Hope is a tricky feeling. Some of us didn't know what hope was, maybe because some of us Nexus kids are only 3 years old, and hope takes a while to learn. Some of us knew what hope felt like, but had a hard time explaining what it meant. The thing that was clearest to us is where hope came from. We see hope when people are trying hard. We see hope when people are kind to one another. We see hope when broken things are being fixed. We feel hope when we hear about people who are trying to help the world. We feel hope when someone apologizes after hurting our feelings. We feel hope when we are waiting for something exciting to happen. We hear hope when people are cheering really loud at a hockey game. We hear hope when we listen to happy music. We hear hope in the wind. Hope is knowing that something good could happen. Hope is a bright light. Hope is finding the silver lining. Hope is feeling that things can get better, whether we're happy or sad. Hope is something we learn about when we are surprised with goodness. Hope is something that grows when we see that hard things can become easier. Hope is something that takes practice.
Wonderful. Thank you, Zoe. And thank you, Nexus Kids. Reflecting. Hope. Gotta find those moments of hope. That's what Easter Sunday is. Movement 4. It's so hard to trust this, though, because where is God when it hurts? Why does God always seem so silent? The resurrection is a reassuring light, but it contains a hard truth. The resurrection is a promise of redemption, not rescue from darkness in the world. It's a story in Scripture, of course, where Jesus' close friend Lazarus is ill. And his sisters, Mary and Martha, send word to Jesus, come, Lazarus is ill. And implicit in the message to Jesus is, hurry up, you need to do something right now. And Jesus curiously decides to wait for 2 days. He waits for 2 days, why we're not told, but he arrives on the scene too late. He arrives on the scene and Lazarus has already passed away. And when the two sisters meet Jesus, their question is, why? Why weren't you here? What took you so long? Why didn't you come when we asked you to, Jesus? It's a question all of us will wrestle with at some point in our life. Why is it that God always seems absent when bad things happen to good people? Why is God seemingly silent in the face of tragedy? Jesus offers no response to them except to go to the burial site and weep. Sits in silence with the sisters and weeps. This is our place in history. God with us, silent, weeping, just as Jesus did. Jesus weeps, but then as the promise of the future, he does something remarkable. He weeps, he shares their pain, but he is silent, and then he goes and brings Lazarus back to life. And the lesson within it is powerful. God doesn't seem interested in intervening to save us from humiliation or pain or death. What God seems to be about is redeeming our humiliation, our pain, and death after the fact. But then movement 5, Jesus walked this valley himself. Jesus lived a life of love, forgiveness, grace, but nobody bought it. Instead, they killed him, and by killing him, it was more than just killing an innocent man. It was a shaming of everything Jesus taught. Shaming of everything Jesus did. It shamed everything Jesus was about. And we see this on the cross, right? If what you're about, Jesus, is actually really, really true, then prove it. If you're not just being stubborn or plain ignorant, have God confirm what your life is about right now. Have God rescue you. And all we get from God is silence. Silence. We can't help but ask ourselves, to God, speak, would you? Where are you? Where were you in the Holocaust, in ethnic genocides? Where are you right now in Gaza, Ukraine? Where are you in the earthquakes and tsunamis and the deaths of countless people taken out by disease, violence, and how unfair life can be at times, and in the quiet moments of pain that are particular to each one of us? What is God's answer? Silence. And yet, God's answer is in the resurrection. God's silence is broken by the resurrection. God responds to our questions and screams about this life with one act. He raises Jesus from the dead. And the promise is this, what God did for Jesus, God will do for the whole created world. And in the resurrection, we are reminded to not mistake God's silence for the end of the story. From the ashes of this world's shame, defeat, failures, ultimately death, resurrection says it will all be brought back. Because do you know what the Holy One can do with dust? That line and that question has been with us since the beginning of Lent. And boy, am I clinging to it here, because the answer to that question comes of the resurrection. Do you not know what the Holy One can do with dust? He can bring it back to life. Movement 6, and this is why I believe the resurrection declares itself to be true. And yet, every Easter Sunday, I ask myself, is it true? Really? It always happens. My drive here is like quick, but It happens without fail. Every Easter Sunday morning, I'm driving here, like, oh, I'm so excited about my Easter sermon. Oh, is it true? Huh. Not a good time for a crisis of faith here, Brad. Not a good time. Is it true that Jesus fills the wine jugs and brings an end to finitude? Is it true that this universe really does have a center that will hold? Is it true that in the darkness there is the warm glow of reassuring light? Or am I just kidding myself? Is it true that God is in the business of redeeming pain and suffering and death? Is it actually true, or is it just a nice idea? Every Easter Sunday morning, along comes Paul, gives me just a little spanking. 1 Corinthians 15 says this, "If Christ has not been raised, our preaching is useless, and so is your faith. If Christ has not been raised, your faith is futile. You're still in your sins. If only for this life we have hope in Christ, we are of all people most to be pitied." I think it's the same with the resurrection. What gives the death and resurrection metaphor its potency is imagining it can actually happen. And we cannot know this in the same way that we know the material world exists, but we can trust it. And this is why, on a personal level, I come back to the heart of my faith. When we think about the rummage sale and everything in the Christian church that needs to go, I still come back to this. It happened. And I believe it to be true. And if it's not, then we might as well throw the whole thing out, because we're most to be pitied. If Jesus wasn't literally raised from the dead, then everything I've said this morning may have some truthiness to it, but it may not be real. If we can't hold to Jesus' resurrection, and then in my mind, the wine does run out, and we are helpless, then suffering and pain and death do have the final word. The center doesn't hold, and there is no glow of reassuring warm light. God neither rescues nor redeems. But what if it is true? What if it is true? I ask myself this every Easter season. What if it's really, really true that Jesus' dead body was made alive again? What if it is true? This morning, my friend Riley texted me. I said, "Friends," text the pastor group, "Friends, the Easter message is weird, but hold to it and don't be scared to be the fool." That's where I am. Maybe it isn't real, I don't know, but I'm holding to it, and if it makes me look foolish, well, I don't care. If it is true, then we are agents of foolishness in a world looking for hope. And if it is true, then it's time for us as individuals, as persons, as a community, to start to dream and hope again. It's time to go back to the start. I love this image in Matthew 28, the resurrection story. The angel said to the woman, "Do not be afraid, for I know that you're looking for Jesus who was crucified. He is not here. He has risen, just as he said. Come and see the place where he lay. Then quickly go and tell his disciples, he has risen from the dead, is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him. Now I have told you." Seems a strange thing. Why not, hey, just meet me here. I'm here. Why is Jesus going to meet them in Galilee? Why Galilee? In the Gospels, Galilee is not simply a geographical location. For Jesus to meet them there is not some random place on the map. Why Galilee? Because that's where it started. That's where Jesus first met them, in Galilee. In Matthew 4, we read that Jesus calls his disciples to follow him around the Sea of Galilee. And so Jesus is saying to them what? I'll meet you back at the start. And we can start to dream again. Galilee is more than a place to these disciples. For them, it refers to that place and that time, that earlier time in their lives when their hearts burned with intense hope. Their hearts burned with enthusiasm as they began to follow Jesus For them, it was the place before the dream of hope had died for them at Jesus' crucifixion. And now after the crucifixion, Jesus is saying to them, just when it feels like the dream is dead, just when it is starting to feel like your faith is only a fantasy, just when you're about to let cynicism and despair set in, go back to the start. Go back to where it all began. Go back to Galilee. I'll meet you there. I'm going to ask the band to come. They go back to Galilee, both to the geographical location, but also to that place in their hearts where they dared to dream and hope. Just as promised, Jesus appears to them there. He doesn't appear as he was before. That's the thing. Some things are different now. They've changed. But he does appear to them, and he's more than a ghost, and he's more than a memory. The Christ that appears to them after the resurrection is almost transhuman, right? Hyperhuman. Can disappear, reappear places, but physical enough to eat fish, physical enough to be touched. That's ultimately what the resurrection asks of us. Let's go back to the start. Maybe it's been a long year for us and cynicism and despair have started to set in. Resurrection Sunday asks us, let's dare to dream again. Let's dare to hope again, to find faith again, a faith that once enlivened us, but now so easily gets lost in disillusionment and despair. What the resurrection asks of us this Sunday, this year, is to go back to the start, to trust once again for another year, perhaps another season, that the wine won't run out, that we aren't helpless forever, that suffering and pain and death do not have the final word, that the center does hold. It asks us to trust that there is a warm, reassuring glow of light. So the resurrection calls us to go back to the start. Go back to that little seed inside of us that once believed that God will someday redeem it all, and dare to put our hope and trust and faith in that. What the resurrection asks of us is to believe that it's true. And that wherever we're disheartened in life, wherever we're discouraged in life, wherever darkness and despair seem to have won the day, wherever our hope seems to be crucified, we head back to Galilee, back to the dream, back to the start.